It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Lots to cover, and starting out with, there is a rally happening right as we are speaking.
We've been doing this program, you've been here longer than that, but I've been doing this segment for 10 years, and I think this is the first time I can remember that there was a major protest rally in town happening directly opposite this program. I mean, 8:30 on a Saturday morning is not prime time for demonstrations. We talked about this last week. There are a number of neighborhood and community groups and activists that have kind of discovered each other in the last couple weeks, and that they have a common foe, namely the Parks and Recreation Department. And so starting at 8:30, opposite the zoo's garage design workshop from 9 to noon, starting at 8:30 at the south entrance to Woodland Park Zoo, they're going to gather, march up to the west entrance where the parking garage is planned, and then have a rally and speakers and things like that. And I'll be scurrying over there after we're done with this program. But people should go check that out. I spent a lot of time this week reporting on the various foibles of Parks and Recreation. There'll be a pretty long story in Seattle Weekly next week about this. And some of it is just dreadful. A lot of the critics for a lot of these different different neighborhood groups are basically saying the same thing, that that Parks has a top-down decision-making style, that they pit different constituencies, whether it's sport users or nature lovers or people who just enjoy a park, against each other, and that they've, particularly under the Nichols administration, really started to discover parks as a revenue stream and using them for commercial interests. We saw that this week on a couple of different fronts. The Friends of Gasworks Park, who should ordinarily be an ally of the Parks Department, filed a lawsuit on Tuesday to try and stop One Rail Productions from having their Summer Nights concert series at Gasworks Park. The suit alleges, probably correctly, that the city and One Rail have not done any kind of environmental review and that they're required to by law for something like this. Ken Bounds, the superintendent of parks, is saying, "Well, we've never done that before," but as one of the neighborhood activists said, just because you've broken the law in the past doesn't mean you can do it now. So that lawsuit was filed. At the same time, there was a pending lawsuit from Pioneer Square activists over the redesign plan and the tree cut at Occidental Park. And unfortunately, that lawsuit is pending. It's got a May court date, and the activists feel pretty confident that they'll win the case, but the trees are likely to be cut down by then. In fact, Parks started working on that this week. They fenced off the park. They took down the pergola. Activists have been tying green ribbons around the trees, and Parks has just been taking those down as fast as they go up, and probably over this weekend or early next week, they'll actually cut down the trees. They can do that because Parks required the neighborhood activists to they originally requested that they post a $190,000 bond for what they said was the cost of a potential delay in the project. The court reduced that to $120,000, but what neighborhood activist group can raise $120,000? So they are stuck. They might have a compelling legal case, but except for damages, it's going to be moot by the time they get to court. Nick Licata on city council tried to get Parks to hold off because of the pending lawsuit, but Parks has just ignored him. And this is kind of an ongoing trend at a lot of places, whether it's the ball fields at Magnuson Park, the new condos at Discovery Park, the parking garage at the zoo, which is said to be in preparation for a new event center. Again, commercial interests like the Summer Nights series, the redesigns, which are very developer friendly at both Occidental Park and Freeway Park, the daylighting of Ravenna Creek. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Check out the story next week. But if you can scoot over there, guzzle down the rest of your coffee and head on over to the south entrance of Woodland Park Zoo, and they'll be hitting up Finney probably around 9 o'clock. And it should be a pretty hard group to miss. I think there'll be a pretty good turnout for this.
Yeah, and you can keep the radio on in your car as you go.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I was. I had mixed reactions to a PI headline this week about activists being monitored. I was kind of jazzed that the PI actually gave it a headline banner.
on page one,
yeah,
on top, above the fold.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, much of the information we already knew. And in fact, we knew more than that information because one of the groups that's been monitored, Ground Zero, and Glenn Milner, who is a part of Ground Zero and is sort of a whiz at getting a Freedom of Information request and other legal documents out of federal agencies, has really documented the monitoring going back several years already of law enforcement saying that that these groups might potentially disrupt Seafair because of the Navy ships there. And of course, you know, that's exactly what Milner and other activists have done. We talked about Milner's Coast Guard hearing in December for exactly that kind of a protest. At the same time, Not in Our Name was also monitored. Raging Grannies was also monitored. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around the concept that they're a threat to national security. But, you know, maybe they are because they have credibility to criticize George Bush because they've seen it all over the course of, you know, 60 or 70 or 80, 90 years. So you know, clearly criticizing George Bush is considered a threat to national security, and that's a lot of what this is about. This may well not be the end of it. I think there's probably a lot more monitoring going on, and not just by the FBI, by the joint federal local anti-terrorism task force, Seattle Police Department, King County Sheriff, Washington State Patrol. I mean, you can just go down the list of law enforcement agencies that have really, especially since the WTO protests in 1999, taken the attitude that street protests is criminalized, that the people don't have a right to do this and that they are a potential threat. It's really pretty discouraging to see our tax dollars being wasted on that, because not only are these folks not a threat, but they're exercising their constitutional rights to agitate for changes in public policy. That's one of the things that democracy is supposed to be about. So hopefully we can get more people who take actions that will require federal monitoring, and they just have so much of it that they have to do that they're swamped and they can't cover it all.
All right, moving along, sticking with local, there's a new Blue Ribbon panel in town.
Yeah, we talked about this a little over a month ago, that the King County Sheriff's Office, a couple of county council members, Julia Patterson and Bob Ferguson, had introduced a plan for a civilian review system for the King County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Sue Rahr, who was reelected last November, is opposing this plan, as are the King County Officers Guild. And what Rahr wanted to do instead was appoint a blue ribbon panel to study the problem of accountability in the Sheriff's Office. I mean, this after just dozens of documented problems with inappropriate behavior by officers, with lax disciplinary measures, you know, poor internal investigations, all this kind of stuff. So Rahr goes ahead and appoints 10 people to this Blue Ribbon Commission this week. It didn't get much attention, but what really really piqued my interest in that is that of those 10, 7 of those 10 members were either cops, or they were affiliated with a court somehow, you know, a judge or a clerk or whatever, or they were lawyers. So they're, you know, all you know, taking oaths in and around the justice system and law enforcement. That is not civilian review. That's a blue ribbon panel that's being dominated in all likelihood by people who have a vested interest and very much believe in the law enforcement system and probably in the status quo. Now, it's not really fair to prejudge. You know, maybe they'll do a fine job and come up with good recommendations, et cetera, but without knowing a lot more about these folks' resumes other than what they do for a living, it doesn't look good.
Yeah, but did you really expect something dramatically different? I mean, from the Blue Ribbon panels that I've seen in the past, they've all been pretty much status quo.
Yeah, but still, we need to publicize that that's what Rahr is doing, and she's doing it as a specific effort to resist a civilian review proposal that's being put forward in county council that has at least 4 votes out of the 9 members on county council. We need one more out of one of the Democrats, I believe. And if we can get that, it's likely to be tied up in court. Certainly the Officers Guild will challenge it on the basis of having to renegotiate their union contract in order to accommodate it. But nonetheless, this is something that RAR is specifically trying to undermine by her effort to appoint a blue ribbon panel instead that in all likelihood is going to identify very different problems than a civilian review board would.
All right. Let's jump over to international, since really the biggest story of this week was, of course, the Shiite shrine in Iraq.
Yeah, in the Askari Mosque in Samarra. This is a huge, huge story. I mean, we'll talk about the Dubai ports world and that story in a little bit. But while that was getting most of the media attention this week, Iraq has gone to hell in a handbasket. And I'm not just talking about the deaths from reprisals against Sunnis by angry Shiites that are understandably upset that one of the holiest shrines in their religion has been destroyed. So something like 150 people have died so far nationally that we know of. And even though there's been a daytime curfew that's been imposed, the violence is continuing today from what I could see from headlines this morning. So there's that issue. But there, even more importantly, there's serious, serious political consequences to this. You can take it for a given that the low-intensity civil war that's already being waged with the Shiite dominated government having been linked to death squads, having been linked to torture in their prisons and detention centers and so forth, and Sunni insurgents carrying out reprisals against Shiites because of that, and suicide bombings and so forth. There was quite a bit of that this week, even before the mosque bombing. But, aside from that, we had the Iraqi Accordance Front, which was the political party for Sunni politicians. They won 44 seats in the December 15th election, and this was something that the U.S. invested virtually all of its political capital to try and plead with the Sunnis to just try the political system, try what George Bush seems to think of as democracy, run candidates, try and form a national unity government. Well, it only took about 24 hours of these violent reprisals before the Iraqi Accordance Front pulled out of the talks for a national unity government. It's not going to happen. Sunnis are not going to participate in the political process at this point and probably aren't likely to anytime in the foreseeable future. That pretty much destroys the entire political strategy of George Bush over the last 3 years. He's been working very hard to try and get Sunnis as well as Shiites and Kurds to participate in a national government, the idea being that if Sunnis get some measure of power there, they will not resort to the insurgency. They'll see that without violence they can achieve many of the same goals. Well, they don't believe that right now, and there's a huge number of weapons in the country. A lot of these militias that mustered this week in response to the bombing really moved very, very quickly. It was almost like they were waiting for this kind of an event to happen so that they could carry out ethnic reprisals and religious-based violence. It's a very, very scary situation. You also had the leading Sunni clerics in the country issuing an unusually blunt and sharp criticism of the leading Shiite clerics for what they said was encouraging the violence by encouraging people to protest. This is not good. Now, The Iraqi government has not been formed yet out of the election. It's expected to be dominated by Shiites, who of course are 60% of the country. But the question at this point is which Shiites will lead the country. The sort of moderate folk who are certainly religious clerics, but don't want to see bloodshed, are willing to try and negotiate a political settlement to the inter-ethnic strife. Are really being discredited right now because they couldn't provide security, because so many Shiites are so angry about this. And what you're getting instead is radical young clerics like Muqtada al-Sadr, who 3 years ago was wanted by the occupying forces of the U.S. military as a desired criminal. He's now a kingmaker among Shiite politicians. He came out, as did the Iranian government, and blamed the U.S. and Israel for the the bombing, which is, I think, a little bit of a stretch. But at the same time, he mustered his Mahdi army, his militia. They were responsible for a lot of the violence. He's got a lot of street credibility in Iraq right now because he's taken on the Americans long before most other Shiite leaders considered it. The Shiites are angry at the Americans right now because the Americans have tried so hard to get Sunnis into the political process, and the Shiites feel like this was the result. Of course, the Sunnis have been leading the anti-American insurgency, so the United States really doesn't have any friends in Iraq right now, and I really don't think there's a whole lot George Bush can do at this point to prevent both a dramatic escalation in Iraq's civil war, number one, and number two, the ascension to power of more radical clerics who will impose Sharia law, who will impose a theocracy that's hostile to the United States and very closely aligned with Iran. This bombing was just a disaster for United States foreign policy and what Bush has been trying to accomplish. And he really set it in motion. You know, the invasion in 2003, it was almost inevitable that this sort of a powder keg was going to happen. You know, it was certainly something that the CIA was warning about when Bush Sr. decided not to invade Iraq in 1991. Obviously the folks who committed the violence are the folks who bear responsibility for the violence, but all of this was set in motion by a decision, many thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C., and it's really stunning how much bloodshed potentially Iraqi, mostly civilians, are going to have to weather as a result of that decision.
It was interesting watching reading the U.S. ambassador to Iraq's response to this. He went on Iraqi television and basically said, if you don't, you know, get your stuff together and present a unified government, then the U.S., you know, can't continue to support you and pass on the U.S. tax dollars. I mean, he actually mentioned the U.S. taxpayers in there.
Not that most Iraqis are benefiting from the spending of those U.S. tax dollars, but yeah, you have most Iraqi political leaders, certainly the United States and other Western leaders, most Arab leaders would really like to see additional violence be prevented. And I think most Iraqis would like to see additional violence be prevented. But there are enough people who want to exact vengeance, in the Shiites' case for 35 years of repression under Saddam, plus this latest bombing, and in the Sunnis' case, reprisals for that, and the anti-American insurgency. There's enough testosterone-fueled young men with weapons that I think a lot of people are going to get killed in Iraq. It's a very frightening situation.
All right. Sticking with international, the U.S. is, along with Israel, is trying to put major pressure on Hamas.
Yeah, Condoleezza Rice was in the Middle East this week. Of course, she was also trying to do damage control for the mosque bombing. But she was also talking to various Arab states about the leadership of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority after the recent elections there. And there have been a lot of accusations, which the Bush administration has been denying, but the Israeli government has not been, that the United States and Israel are going to enter into a very specific strategy to try and economically choke off the Palestinian Authority and thus hopefully upset Palestinians enough that they will call for new elections and boot Hamas out of power. There are a number of problems with this strategy, among them that most Palestinians at this point are not about to give the United States or Israel the satisfaction of determining who can and can't rule their fledgling nation state. But the problem with this is that Palestinians' economy, because of the Israeli military occupation, because of the checkpoints, because of the apartheid wall, because of the restrictions on jobs and border crossings, there's a massive unemployment among Palestinians. A lot of Palestinians are dependent on foreign aid, which is funneled through the Palestinian Authority. So when the United States and Israel is threatening this, this. They're literally threatening the ability of ordinary Palestinians to get enough money to buy food and seek shelter. It's a very cruel policy of executing mass reprisals against the Palestinian people because of what they decided to do in a democratic election. Now, Condoleezza Rice's trip this week was notably unsuccessful. Egypt and Saudi Arabia, who have been two of the major supporters of the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, have said they're going to continue and may in fact escalate their financial support of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority if they are cut off by the U.S. and Israel. And Israel has already cut off their payment of taxes and service fees that they owe to the Palestinian Authority, and we're talking tens of millions of dollars that Israel owes that it just up and decided not to pay. At the same time, Iran, which has very close ties to Hamas as well as Hezbollah, announced also this week that it would financially support Hamas and financially support the Palestinian Authority. So, a lot of the oil money in the Middle East, a lot of the Arab states, along with Iran and the Middle East, are going to try and step in and support the Palestinian Authority financially, where the United States and Israel and potentially UN agencies, if the U.S. and Israel get their way. Of course, the European Union also doesn't recognize Hamas and won't deal with them. So we're likely to see, again, a real division between the U.S. and Israel on one hand and most of the Middle East on the other. We keep choosing strategies in the midst of a war on terror that should be about persuasion rather than conquest. We keep choosing strategies that anger Muslims, that anger Arabs, really cause hardship for people in that region.
All right. Something else that got a lot of press this week was the United Arab Emirates company that's in the process of indirectly purchasing multiple port terminal facilities.
Yeah, six of them. The company is called Dubai Ports World. It's actually, I think, the largest operator of ports in the world. It's owned by the Emirate of the United Arab Emirates. So it's a government-owned company. And George Bush is getting reamed politically on this. A Rasmussen Report poll that was done this week suggested that only 17% of Americans approve of the sale. And a lot of it is really disingenuous, but Bush is quite correct that there's really not that much of a difference in the security threat of having a foreign-owned company from the UK and having a foreign-owned company from Dubai. But the problem is that Bush, for so many years since 9/11, has basically lumped in all Arabs and all Muslims together. That's how we wound up getting a majority of Americans thinking that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. There's no diversity among Muslims. They're all alike. So if the United Arab Emirates is in the Middle East and a couple of the 9/11 hijackers came from that country and there was money funneled through that company, which is the financial center of the Middle East, then all Arabs must be bad. And that really is the bigotry that a lot of this opposition, I think, is coming from. But it's bigotry that was fueled by the Bush administration. So he's really coming back and getting bit on some of his own political tactics. It's really kind of interesting that way. To me, the real issue here isn't national security. It's the privatization of port facilities. It's that the United Arab Emirates and the Bush administration was, before this sale came up, was already in the process of negotiating a free trade agreement. And the Bush administration does not want to endanger that free trade agreement by angering the UAE. That is a major reason why Bush is threatening a veto, why he's willing to take such an unpopular stand. He's doing it in the name of free trade. He's doing it in the name of corporate interests. And in this case, even though much of the criticism is based on national security, he's making his priority priorities very clear. Corporate interests take priority over national security, which is, you know, something that, that people who have been following the Bush administration and, you know, the privatization of the military, for example, have known for a while. But for people who've just sort of been paying casual attention to the evening news, this is a real revelation, and it's angering people. I think Bush is going to be really hurt by this issue.
All right, moving along. I had missed it earlier in the week, but when I was perusing the papers again this morning, I saw that the Supreme Court is looking at wrestling with partial birth abortions.
Yeah, two federal appeals courts, the Ninth in California and the Second in New York, have both ruled that Congress's law passed a few years ago banning partial birth abortions is unconstitutional because it doesn't make provisions for saving the health of the mother if her health is endangered by the pregnancy. And, you know, the Ninth Circuit also cited Roe v. Wade and the fundamental right to an abortion. But even though the appeals courts have supported finding that this law is unconstitutional, it's pretty likely to be reversed by the Supreme Court. And we're about to see why. We're about to see why Samuel Alito was a bad idea on the Supreme Court, because this is the first major Roe v. Wade-related case that he's going to be able to rule on. And it seems almost certain that he and Scalia and Thomas and Kennedy and I'm missing one, but there's five that are pretty solidly against this. So, you know, unless there's a real surprise, which there sometimes is in the Supreme Court, we're going to see that upheld. And along with the state of South Dakota passing a law that essentially bans abortions this week, and the governor has said he's going to sign that, and of course there will be court challenges to that too. But we're beginning to see the beginning of the end of Roe v. Wade, if not in terms of the constitutionality. So much of it has been chipped away now by various little pieces and laws here and there that functionally, for a lot of women in a lot of parts of the country, abortions are simply not available already. And we're just going to see that increase with a conservative Supreme Court. It's very frightening.
All right, and there's an update on the Valerie Plame, Valerie Wilson situation?
Yeah, Jason Leopold at Truthout, who has been a great reporter on this issue, is reporting this morning that the White House has handed over to Patrick Fitzgerald 250 pages of recently discovered emails from the period of time in June of, I believe it was 2003, when Valerie Wilson was being targeted because of Joseph Wilson's criticisms of the Bush administration and the run-up to the Iraq War. A lot of these documents apparently show that Dick Cheney, the vice president, was in up to his neck in the in a conspiracy to leak Valerie Wilson's covert identity and violate national security laws. If this report is true, and Leopold's been very good at getting sources from this case in the past, Cheney could be in real legal trouble here. It'll be very interesting to follow and see if see what Fitzgerald does with this information. We already knew that the emails were missing. Now we know that he's obtained some of them, and the content of that will be very interesting.
30 seconds or less. A federal judge is pushing for some names released for Guantanamo.
Yeah, Jed Rakoff of New York, U.S. District Judge, has ordered on Thursday that the Pentagon, in response to an AP lawsuit, release the names of detainees at Guantanamo. This is something the military, both for current and former detainees, this is something that the military and the Bush administration have been resisting hard for the last 4 years. And finally, we're going to find out who some of these people are, and hopefully what their background is, and whether they deserve to be in Guantanamo at all.
All right. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State covers a lot of the types of issues that you hear on this program. It's a community newspaper that comes out every other week. You can find it at places where you get free newspapers, bookstores, cafes, etc. It's distributed through the King County Library System, for example. You can find it around. It's also on the web, not only the current issue, but all of the back issues for the last 10 years at www.eatthestate.org. And there's a blog there also. There's a lot of useful and good information. So check it out. And if you have comments, questions, feedback, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to donate, any of that good stuff, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.